Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It is time to sunset the authorization for the war in Iraq. If the president will not bring himself to accept reality, it is time for Congress to bring reality to him.
Senator Hillary Clinton from earlier this year over her newly chosen campaign theme song, as announced by the campaign yesterday by Celine Dion. Does this speak Hillary to you? So we will talk now about how Mayor Bloomberg leaving the Republican Party might affect the Clinton for President campaign, and more about her candidacy and her record with New York Times correspondent Don Van Natta. He is co-author of one of those several new books about Senator Clinton, one of the more critical ones. It's called Her Way, The Hopes and Ambitions of Hillary Rodham Clinton, published by Little Brown. Don, thanks for coming on WNYC today. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Let me start with the Bloomberg news. And so far, the Clinton campaign is declining comment, at least as far as I saw earlier this morning, on any possible Bloomberg independent candidacy. From what you know of the Clinton campaign machine, what steps might they be taking now to prepare for such a possibility?
Well, they're concerned about it. I had a conversation this morning with a strategist for Senator Clinton, and they are concerned. She can ill afford to have an independent candidate of Mayor Bloomberg's stature in the race because she doesn't. Her negative ratings are quite high among independents, and she is counting on the fact that if she is the Democratic nominee and there's not an independent in the race, that she can still pull some of those independents. But with an independent in the race, I think she can have some votes siphoned off from her, and really could be some trouble.
That's pretty interesting. What do you know about the relationship, if you know anything, between Bloomberg and Clinton? Do they work closely with each other? Do they like each other?
I believe they do like each other. I don't know how closely they've worked together, but I believe there's a mutual respect there.
How would Hillary Clinton run against Michael Bloomberg if it comes to that? Hasn't she said a lot of nice things about him as mayor?
She has. She's been very positive about him as a leader, and it would be interesting to see how she would navigate that. He is a threat, a distant threat, but a threat to the campaign. And it doesn't surprise me they haven't said anything about it yet.
And just because he left the Republican Party yesterday and declared himself officially an independent on voter registration forms doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to run for president. There are other things that he may have in mind, like just influencing the debate or keeping his clout at a maximum level in New York as he's a lame duck. Nobody really knows. But one of my guesses is that it would be less likely that he even runs at all if either Clinton or Giuliani is in the race because he's got such prior relationships with both of them.
I think that's a terrific analysis. One thing that strikes me is we may actually have three New Yorkers in the presidential race between Giuliani, Bloomberg, and Senator Clinton, and that would really be something. But I think that's smart analysis, Brian. It's not a certainty that he's going to jump in, but it's certainly the betting is better on it today than it was yesterday.
Right. And, of course, one complication with my analysis is that he can't really wait till the conventions, till the nominating process, if there's any suspense in either of the parties. I guess with, Super Duper Tuesday coming in early February, maybe he'll have a pretty good idea by then whether the scenario is right for him to run or not.
Yeah, if he's going to make a move, he's going to have to make it pretty soon because of that front-loaded primary schedule that you made reference to.
But he doesn't need primary. So there's the going analysis, I think, is that he doesn't have to make a move too soon. In fact, there would almost be no point in him making it during 2007.
I guess that's true. I would be surprised, though, if he waits too long in 2008. I mean, I think that these things need momentum, and I would be very surprised if he pulled off an April, May, June surprise of 08. I would guess that if he is going to get into it, it's going to be sooner rather than later.
Don Van Natta, my guest on WNYC, New York Times, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative correspondent. His new book is called Her Way, The Hopes and Ambitions of Hillary Rodham Clinton. We can take your phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC or post a comment on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Let me be honest with you about one of my reactions to your book, which is that there has been so much ink spilled about Whitewater and the Rose Law Firm and Hillary at Wesleyan and how the health care reform went south in 94, why she has stayed married to Bill, even her positions on the Iraq War. Why should anyone care to hear any more rehash rather than focus on what Clinton is going to do as president on the issues that affect our lives?
Well, for one thing, the book is not a rehash. The standard that Jeff Gerth and I had for the book was to find new information about every aspect of her political and professional career, and I believe we've accomplished it. The reason we took on the project is Hillary says herself she's the most famous person that people don't really know. And a friend of hers who's known her 35 years says she's a challenge even to her friends. And so she's this enigmatic figure despite all of her fame. And we decided to go back and we say new things about Whitewater. We say new things about the Rose Law Firm. But I want your listeners to understand that most of the book, the big chunk of the book, is about her career in the Senate. And there's no other book that looks at that. That's her record that she's running on to be the next president. And we go into a lot of detail about that. And I think, you know, readers will really be fascinated by some of the things we found.
By the way, I think I said Wesley, and of course she went to Wellesley. One of the stories from your book, and I want to get to some of her Senate record in a couple of minutes, but one of the stories from your book that has broken out in the news is this pact, and you use that word, that she and Bill supposedly made when they were young to remake the Democratic Party and both become president. Now, you got this from Clinton's former chief of staff, Leon Panetta?
Correct. That's right. Well, this was a pact. Before the Clintons exchanged their marriage vows, they exchanged their political vows. In Arkansas, in the mid-1970s, when they were in their mid-20s, they decided they were going to set out to remake the Democratic Party and to make Bill Clinton president within 20 years. The 20-year project, as it was called, was from Bill Clinton's mouth to Leon Panetta, who told us on the record, and a second source confirmed that he also heard President Clinton talk about this. What we also found out, though, is that in 1993, when Bill Clinton was elected president, he, of course, like any first-term president, wanted a second term for himself, but told a friend of his that he also believed Hillary would someday run for president and that he wanted, of course, 8 years for her. So this 8+8 plan was on top of the 20-year project.
But why not? I guess part of my reaction to this is that it's hardly news that they both had ambition to be president. But by reporting it as a pact, and maybe Leon Panetta told you that Clinton used that word, but by using that word, you make it sound kind of sinister, like a coup attempt. Is that your intent?
Not at all. No, there was no intention to make it sound like a coup attempt. We simply quoted Leon Panetta's recollection of a conversation he had with Bill Clinton in the fall of 1996 on Air Force One. It was Bill Clinton who called it a 20-year project. What I think it shows how it reveals the ambition that this couple has had from the very beginning. There's nothing wrong with ambition. And as you point out, Brian, it maybe shouldn't surprise us. But in Hillary's own book and her 2003 autobiography, Living History, she barely mentions any personal ambition at all. She makes it sound as if she decided to run for the Senate in New York by popular demand as opposed to something she had been planning. So
right.
So it's a gap in her own biography.
But that's something, again, that I think would be typical for a politician. If somebody is running for the Senate, they're not going to say, I'm using this as a stepping stone to the presidency, even if they have that ambition, no matter who it is. They're going to say, I want to serve the people of this state.
Well, there's a lot of interest and curiosity in the Clintons' marriage. And I feel that this is a fact that people can look to sort of help explain what the glue that has been the glue that has kept them together. And it really is ambition.
I'll give you another example that came to my mind of, you know, something that may be similar but doesn't get seen in the same light. The first President Bush certainly cultivated the possibility of one of his kids running for president, never mind that it may have been the wrong one. But, you know, they probably sat around the kitchen table in Kennebunkport and thought, God, wouldn't it be great someday if Jeb or George also wound up being elected president of the United States? Is that dynasty building somehow more benign?
That's a great question. I mean, there were stories about that. I think that dynasty building now that we have had two Bush presidents and we may have two Clinton presidents, and there might be 28 years of Bushes and Clintons in the White House, is an important fact for people to know. And we put it out there and let people decide.
You have a lot in here about Clinton's record in the Senate, as you say, including her evolution on the Iraq War. We'll play another clip in a minute. We started with that one from recently. What's important to know, in your opinion, about Clinton and Iraq that we don't already know?
Well, there's a lot. It's quite revealing about her political calculations that she's made over the last 5 years. In 2002, before she voted for the Iraq War resolution, she didn't do her homework. She did not read the 90-page national intelligence estimate that was made available to all 100 senators.
And as we've heard in the Democratic and Republican debates of recent weeks, neither did anyone else in Congress who's running for president except Duncan Hunter.
Right, that's correct. But Senator Clinton made the mistake, I think, of going on the Senate floor when she voted for the Iraq War resolution. And she made a link, unlike any of her Democratic colleagues, between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. She said that Saddam Hussein actually was keeping some al-Qaeda members inside Iraq and protecting them. And if she had read the 90-page national intelligence estimate, she would have seen that there were major questions within the intelligence community about that fact. And she didn't. She said she was briefed by people, including people in the administration. Well, as we know, it wasn't in the administration's interest to communicate those doubts about whether there was a link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, because President Bush and Vice President Cheney were making those very strong arguments at the time.
So John Edwards was in the Senate, admitted that he didn't read it either. Sam Brownback was in the Senate, admitted that he didn't read it either.
Those are good points, Brian. But, you know, former Senator Edwards has also said his vote was a mistake. And in that way, he's different from Senator Clinton. Senator Clinton has steadfastly refused to say her war vote was a mistake. And she's really playing a game of she's really on the sort of a political high wire act here. She's hoping that she can get through the Democratic primaries and be the nominee without deeply offending the sort of anti-war wing of the Democratic Party. And I think she's made a calculation that she can do that because she doesn't want to admit it's a mistake because it can hurt her in the general election.
So here is something that Hillary Clinton said about the war going back to December 7th, 2002. This is Hillary Clinton on NBC's Meet the Press. We've used this on the show before, and actually in this version of it, you're going to hear our theme music underneath. But Hillary Clinton, Meet the Press, December 2002.
I think that it has to be said that our intelligence was wrong. And it wasn't just our current intelligence, though, Tim. This was intelligence going back into my husband's administration, going back to the first President Bush's administration.
So that was one iteration of her policy on Iraq.
Yes.
You want to put that into context? And she even used a line that supporters of the war use to this day, which is that even the Clinton administration had intelligence that made them believe that there were weapons of mass destruction.
Well, yes. Her husband in December of 1998, right around the time of his impeachment, actually bombed a bunch of suspected WMD sites inside Iraq. So partly Senator Clinton was sort of hemmed in by her husband's legacy on Iraq. Bill Clinton had said in the late 90s that Saddam Hussein was developing weapons of mass destruction and would possibly use them someday. And that was part of the calculation she made when she decided to vote for the war.
But here is Hillary Clinton on February 12th of this year.
Well, I have said, and I will repeat it, that knowing what I know now, I would never have voted for it. But I also, and I mean, obviously you have to weigh everything as you make your decisions. I have taken responsibility for my vote. The mistakes were made by this president who misled this country and this Congress into a war that should not have been waged.
Okay, Senator Clinton at one of the New Hampshire events, that might have been reacting to a questioner in the debate when they had individual members of the audience asked some of the questions, or it might have been at a campaign stop, I don't remember. But here's the difference between her and Edwards that I want to discuss for a minute. You brought it up. Edwards has said he regrets his vote. She hasn't. But this is the line that she's used over and over again. And how different is it really? She says, knowing what I know now, I would never have voted for it. How different is that from saying I regret my vote?
There's a slight difference. You know, saying that my vote was a mistake, there's a theme that runs through Senator Clinton's public life, and we go into this in some detail in the book. She is always reluctant to admit that she made a mistake. Even in the healthcare debacle of 93-94, she has said that that was a mistake, but she always puts it in the we. She rarely says it's I made missteps at that time. And
she was leading a team.
She was leading a team.
A big team.
Ira Magaziner was with her as a partner, and certainly there was enough blame to go around. But this is you're right. It's a very slight difference, but it's a difference that rings very loudly to the anti-war segment of the Democratic Party. These are words right. They want her to hear. And there was a person who literally drove to New Hampshire and confronted her from New York. It was a New York constituent of hers that back in February, mm-hmm. and challenged her. Did you read the National Intelligence Estimate? And actually screamed it at Senator Clinton.
You're not going to hang a character issue though on the difference between using we and using I, right?
No, I don't think so. I'm simply saying that there's a pattern with Senator Clinton. She doesn't like to admit mistakes. She's sensitive to criticism, and on this particular point, she is gambling that she can get through the Democratic primaries, not admit it's a mistake, because if she does, she feels it'll hurt her in a general election.
And again, how different is that from most other politicians who don't go around admitting mistakes? That's one of the reasons that John Edwards made such news.
No, I think that's a good point. I'm simply her choice of words are quite careful on this, and saying I've taken responsibility for my vote is probably as close as you can come to saying I've made a mistake without saying it.
I guess my over
and it's been a good strategy, Brian. I mean, you know, she is doing quite well in the polls. She's extended her lead over Senator Obama and over Senator Edwards, and these issues are not gaining traction with Democratic voters.
Right. And my overarching question, which, you know, the theme of a lot of my questioning for you so far is, are you taking things that are perfectly ordinary for top politicians and making them sound extraordinary and unique to Hillary Clinton? Because I think the media in general does that a lot.
I disagree. I look, what we did, she said that the Iraq vote was the most important vote of her life. It was the hardest decision she had of her life. The 5 years since then, her evolution on this subject is fascinating. And we lay out in the book that she has not always been straight with people about her hawkish statements that she made prior to the war. She's trying to make the case to the American people that she was against the war before she voted for it, and now she's against it again.
We'll continue in a minute with Don Van Natta, author of Her Way, The Hopes and Ambitions of Hillary Rodham Clinton. We'll take your phone calls for him. Maybe you've seen him elsewhere in the press. Maybe you've read the book or reviews of the book or excerpts of the book. We can talk about the Bloomberg run. You can even talk about the Bill and Hillary Sopranos send-up. We will mention that when we continue, and some of her positions on some of the issues, which we'll get to as well. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post your comments at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show.
If we in Congress don't end this war before January 2009, as president, I will.
All right, again, Senator Clinton speaking about the war in Iraq. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Let's see, that one was from Fox News Sunday in early February of this year. Actually, they played that. She said it somewhere else. They played it on Fox News Sunday as part of a montage. If we in Congress don't end this war before January 2009, as president, I will. But Don Van Natta from The New York Times, I've never understood that particular statement, because she said, I think as recent as yesterday at the forum she was at with a couple of the other candidates, that there is a need for some troop presence in Iraq even after something called a withdrawal. So it's unclear to me, you know, really, with almost any of the candidates, just how they would pursue the war or not.
There's a disconnect between those two, absolutely. But Senator Clinton has made it clear, as you point out, that some presence will be needed. But any time on the stump when she says, if this president doesn't end the war and I will in January 2009, it gets the biggest applause. So she's going to continue to use it, even though the devil's in the details and there may be some small presence.
Right. And even John Edwards at that forum yesterday said, well, we'll have to leave some troops in Iraq, at very least to protect the embassy. And Bill Richardson took some issue with that and said, no, if the embassy is in that much danger, then I'll bring the staff home from the embassy. And, you know, so, you know, again, it's everybody's nuanced. And she has this history of change that we can track. But then Edwards is out there being, everybody's out there being nuanced.
It's true. Again, but I want to stress that of all the Democratic senators, Senator Clinton was the most hawkish on the war, right, even more than Joe Lieberman in her remarks. And we argue in the book that part of the motivation for that was the fact that she had an eye down the road to possibly running for president. And as the first woman president, she was really going to need to prove her toughness, to show that she was up to the task of being a commander-in-chief during the so-called war on terrorism, and that that was also part of her calculation in being as tough in her rhetoric as she was at the time of making that vote.
Let's take a call. This is Piyush. Do I have that right? In Princeton, you're on WNYC.
Thank you for taking my call. It's Piyush. I wanted to make a point about Senator Clinton's vote and the controversy around her apologizing and not apologizing. And the point I wanted to make really was that any intelligent person would have to be open to additional information and be open to the possibility that their opinion would change. And given the information that was available then, she made a decision. And as more information became available, her opinion would change and her position would change. And I think it's only fair that we allow for that to happen in a democratic society where our elected officers are also held to the same standard as any other intelligent person would be held to. So I think I just wanted to make a point that our insistence on her apologizing is in some ways ridiculous.
Piyush, do you feel the same way about Mitt Romney and his new positions?
I do. I think I do. I mean, it's the evolution of thought and the sort of the as more information becomes available, the possibility of changing your opinion should be a very natural process. And this getting hung up on she hasn't apologized on record, I think, is missing the point.
Thank you for your call.
Yeah, I want to make it clear. I'm not insisting that Senator Clinton needs to apologize. I simply have pointed out it's something that the anti-war wing of the party is demanding. But to your point about whether she actually can change with the times, there's nothing wrong with that. The point we make in the book is that she did not do all the homework she needed to do prior to making this very important vote. And she also has mischaracterized another vote that she took at that time. She has criticized President Bush for not doing enough on the diplomatic front prior to invading Iraq. She had an opportunity to insist with a vote. It's called the Levin Amendment in October of 2002 that would have required President Bush to try to seek a second UN resolution and come back to the Congress if we were to use force against Iraq, and she voted against that. So we simply point out that some of the things she's now saying about her record are not quite true, not backed up by the facts.
What I really want to know as a voter is, what will she do about the war if elected that would be different from any of the other candidates? Can your research give us any insight into that?
Well, our research shows that it's tough to know precisely what Senator Clinton will do. I mean, unlike some other candidates and other presidents who have a core set of convictions, like Ronald Reagan, for instance, just a few things he believes in, and he's not going to move from that. On the war, Senator Clinton has shown that she is really all over the map. So I don't know. And you know, this sort of inconsistency between her statements that you highlighted at the beginning of this segment, Brian, I mean, that's troubling for me as well. What exactly is she going to do? And because she has said so many different things. Look, earlier this year, she said that she was not going to deauthorize the war. And then, sure enough, she voted for it just last month. So she has said certain things that she has contradicted in a matter of months. And I think that's troublesome.
Michael in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Don Van Natta. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I feel that based on a writing of Mr. Van Natta and in particular his co-author Jeff Gerth in the past, that there's reason to believe that both of these gentlemen have it in for the Clintons. Mr. Gerth wrote the first article about Whitewater. It was about 80-90% false, and yet it was repeated again and again in papers around the country and around the world.
What was false about the story? I don't think you're being accurate. There was nothing false about the story.
Well,
the headline was slightly inaccurate. The headline was unfortunate. But tell me,
what was the headline?
The headline was Clintons and are in a land deal with an SNL operator, suggesting that when the deal was struck, he was an SNL operator and he was not.
So that was back in 92, that story?
In March of 1992, that's right. So the headline was misleading, and that's been talked about. But what in the story was inaccurate? There's no inaccuracies in the story.
Well,
and it's the only story, by the way, that Jeff Gerth ever wrote about Whitewater.
The only story? Is that what you're saying?
The only story.
Well, it was the only story. It was repeated over and over again. 80 to 90% of what was written in it, according to a journalism review, was what was repeated in story after story.
Yeah, but there was But, sir, with all due...
Gene Lyon's book, The Hunting of the President, the 10-year campaign to destroy Bill and Hillary Clinton, in which they very effectively go through all the details of this and show that it was wrong, that he was relying on people who were biased, that he seemed to have an appetite to get dirt, even when there wasn't any dirt there.
Well, sir, with all due respect, there was an independent counsel investigation. The president, President Clinton, asked for an independent counsel to investigate this. Fisk was the first one. He was replaced by Ken Starr. They investigated this matter, and it ended up leading to the Monica Lewinsky scandal and to the impeachment of President Clinton. Jeff Gerth's initial story is accurate. I take exception to what you say. And I also want to say on my behalf, I've written stories that Hillary Clinton absolutely loved while I was in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. If you remember, during the Lewinsky scandal, she said there's a vast right-wing conspiracy out to get her and her husband. Well, I set out to try to prove whether that was true and actually did find out that there was some pretty questionable connections between some lawyers working behind the scenes for Paula Jones, who helped get the Linda Tripp allegations about Monica Lewinsky into Ken Starr's office. I was the first reporter to break that story. The Gene Lyon's book that you talk about actually says very nice things about my reporting. So I don't know what in my past you're referring to that's anti-Clinton when I've written a story that helped prove Hillary's assertion that there was a vast right-wing conspiracy.
There's another new book out about Hillary Clinton that often gets paired with yours and book reviews and other things, and it's the one by Carl Bernstein, the Washington Post reporter. And he concludes, I thought I had this quote in front of me, but I guess I don't. He concludes something to the effect that Senator Clinton is ultimately rooted in values and has strong convictions and beliefs and pursues her politics, harsh politics as they are at times in the hardball world of Washington, to the end of, you know, of the things that she has long believed. And in fact, I think, again, a lot of the media tries to portray Clinton at once as somebody who has no values and only has ambition, and at the same time as a radical left liberal who wants her liberal agenda to prevail. I'm not saying you say that, but the critics can't have it both of those ways.
Yeah, well, we don't say either one of those things in the book.
Well, you did say earlier that you were focusing on her ambition and that she's tremendously driven. So to what degree would you disagree with Carl Bernstein's conclusion that she's got a core set of beliefs and values at the heart of this?
She does have a core set of beliefs and values, and we point that out in the book. She cares very deeply about children's issues. She was, you know, really a trailblazer in that area during the 70s. Women's issues, she's been out front. She does have certain domestic issues that she cares very deeply about. What I have found troubling about her record in the Senate is that because she has needed to burnish her national security credentials after 9/11, that she has done it in a way that I don't think personally, I know what her core beliefs are on national security. I mean, she has, as I've said, been all over the map. But I agree with the assertion clearly that she wants to do good works for the American people and will do anything in her power to be in a position to do that. And there's nothing wrong, by the way, with her being ambitious. I want to be clear about that. As I said, I was struck by her autobiography, how little she said about it. And I felt people would be interested to know that as early as the mid-70s, that they were thinking about remaking the Democratic Party, Bill and Hillary, and they set out and did it.
Don Van Natta, New York Times correspondent, my guest on WNYC, and now co-author of Her Way, The Hopes and Ambitions of Hillary Rodham Clinton. What else is notable in her Senate record? What else do you explore in her actual Senate record?
Well, we look at her on energy, for instance. And interestingly, in an attempt to catch up to Al Gore on the environment and energy issues, she actually consulted a secret energy task force that was impaneled for her in 2006. And in developing her energy policies, she actually, interestingly, chose to ignore some of the recommendations that were made from those experts. And this is something that's not known before. The mainstream media has never written about it. And it's something that we reveal in the book.
And so where did that land her? Again, what does it mean that we can expect from her as president on energy if she's elected?
Well, it certainly indicates a good thing that she is looking for advice and seeking out advice. I mean, she did this quietly because I think she was possibly concerned that some of the people that were advising her, just as Vice President Cheney had problems, she was looking to avoid that kind of a problem. But what it says about her is that she does seek advice and she didn't necessarily accept it. So she does, you know, march to the beat of her own drums, even on energy.
Right. And again, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing. Absolutely.
What else? You want to pick another policy area?
Another policy area. Well, one thing that we were really struck by, and it's not gotten a lot of attention in our book, is the way she administers her Senate office. She uses, again, this is goes back to the energy, consulting the Energy Task Force. She uses a lot of fellows. They're basically interns and temporary employees that work for her. And at any one time, she may have half a dozen, eight or nine of these people working with her. She failed to file reports with the Secretary of the Senate about these people. And it's possibly a violation of the Senate ethics rules. And what's interesting about it is that it's, again, another example of her secrecy. She is an advocate for an open and honest government, but she hid from public disclosure the fact that she had a number of people working with her. We call it the mysteries of Hillary Land in the book. And Hillary Land is a formidable political empire, and it's not even known to the Secretary of the Senate just how large it is.
By the way, on her history of criticizing the president on Iraq while trying to be a hawk, you probably know this. The group Media Matters, Liberal Media Watch group, criticizes your book in some specific terms, and they go all the way back to October 17th, 2003, to cite a statement by Clinton on the floor of the Senate. Quote, "We disagree with the way he used that authority." So when you talk about her revisionism now, well, at least it goes all the way back to October 17th of the year the war was launched. So is there really that much of a change?
There is a change. Media Matters actually tried to get the New York Times to correct a single sentence. We had an 8,000-word excerpt of our book that ran on the cover of the Sunday Times magazine. And on this particular point that you just raised, they tried to get the New York Times to correct it, saying as early as 2003, Hillary was saying that she disagreed with the way the president used his authority. It wasn't until 2006, however, that she actually accused him specifically, saying what he did with his authority was wrong. I mean, saying you disagree with something and accusing the president of misusing it are two entirely different things. And the New York Times editors took a careful look at the Media Matters allegation. They decided that our story was accurate, and they did not do a correction, which, of course, upset the folks at Media Matters quite a bit.
Also in the news today, the first announcement of Bill Clinton to be used on the campaign trail at an appearance in Iowa. What do you make of it?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see the dynamic between Bill and Hillary on the campaign trail. The last time on a really public way that they were together speaking was back during the Coretta Scott King Memorial Service in early 2006. And Bill Clinton spoke first. He had the congregation eating out of his hands. He's just so good in that form. He's a natural. And when Senator Clinton followed, she read from a script and it didn't go over nearly as well. And strategists told us that it was really a debacle for her. And so to see their dynamic and to see the way they interact will be very interesting.
Can she open for him or can't it play out that way if she's the candidate?
It's going to be interesting to see how it plays. Look, the Sopranos video that they put up on the website yesterday is really, I think, fascinating and revealing because what it shows is it shows Senator Clinton is in charge. Bill Clinton really is number two. He's playing second fiddle to her all the way down to the fact that Senator Clinton won't let him eat onion rings and says, you know, you got to have your carrot sticks and I'm looking out for you.
We have the audio of that.
Oh, great.
And so for people who have been hearing about this, take off on the last scene of The Sopranos as a Hillary Clinton campaign video with Bill. Now, we should say it's Hillary in the role of Tony.
That's right. Hillary.
Not Bill.
That's right. That's right. Bill, and Bill is Carmella.
And here's some of it.
Anything look good?
We have some great choices. I ordered for the table.
No onion rings?
I'm looking out for you. Where's Chelsea?
Parallel parking. How's the campaign going?
Well, like you always say, focus on the good times.
So what's the winning song?
You'll see.
My money's on Smash Mouth. Everybody in America wants to know how it's going to end.
Ready?
And then they go into the winning song that they had this contest for, choosing her campaign song. But there it is with the Journey song in the background, putting the coin in the jukebox at the very end, the parallel parking, the whole thing. But what's the point? I've already heard criticism of this, frankly, from liberal Democrats who say she should be out there talking about health care and the war and energy and things like that. Instead, she's having this, you know, funny poll on something that doesn't matter, which is a campaign song, and then playing around, you know, taking the role of a sociopathic mob boss.
Well, she's trying to connect with audiences, and I actually think it's quite effective. I don't know if the song is going to be effective. The Celine Dion song "You and I" was actually written for an Air Canada commercial, so how effective that's going to be remains to be seen.
That's really authentic,
and I had to chuckle that of course Bill Clinton said he likes Smash Mouth. You know, they've been known to play some Smash Mouth politics, the Clintons.
All right, that's where we're going to leave it with Don Van Natta, along with Jeff Gerth, both of the, Gerth was with the New York Times for a long time, is no longer. Don Van Natta is still an investigative reporter with the New York Times. They have written Her Way, The Hopes and Ambitions of Hillary Rodham Clinton, published by Little Brown. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Enjoyed it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, we'll be showing that video on a TV show I'll be hosting tonight, 7:30 tonight on CUNY TV, Channel 75, on the New York City cable systems. I can see your love.